Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with writers in the studios of North State Public Radio. Now here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
I'm Nancy Wiegman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. Desmond Tutu called Bryan Stevenson America's Nelson Mandela. Mr. Stevenson is also an author, and his book about mass incarceration in America, Just Mercy, A Story of Justice and Redemption, is this year's Book in Common. He is founder and executive director of the Equal Justice Initiative, a nonprofit committed to fighting poverty and challenging racial discrimination in the criminal justice system. He has argued 5 times before the Supreme Court and is the recipient of a MacArthur Genius Award. He's a graduate of Harvard Law School and is on the faculty at New York University School of Law. Bryan Stevenson, welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf. Your book, Just Mercy, is about mass incarceration. That's a tough sell. So what compelled you to write this book?
Well, I'm just persuaded that if people saw what I see on a regular basis, if they understood the things that I've learned over the course of my career, they would really want change. What we're doing in many parts of this nation is simply unacceptable. We're just tolerating abuse and cruelty and injustice in ways that I don't think most people would accept, but there's this information gap. And the book was really an attempt to bridge that gap, to get people closer to the realities of mass incarceration and to, I think, the shame of what's happened to too many people for too long.
Well, you know what I like is that you shake us out of our indifference with a story. And what was this story that got you started on this path?
Well, I do think that narrative is really important. We understand things much more intimately when they're framed by narrative. That's certainly what happened to me. I was a law student about to reconcile myself to a career as a lawyer that I knew was not going to be fully affirming, not going to be terribly gratifying when I went to Georgia to work with lawyers representing people on death row. And it was meeting a condemned man who was burdened with chains, handcuffs on his wrists, shackles on his ankles, a chain around his waist, and seeing him respond to just my presence, to just being told that he wasn't at risk of execution any time in the next year, to see how, even in my ignorance, I could have an impact on the quality of this man's life was really quite powerful for me. And then we had this long conversation where we were just talking and discovering that we weren't so different before guards came into the room and treated him pretty roughly, threatened him, and were putting the handcuffs on very tightly. And before they forced him out of the room, this man looked at me and he said, Bryan, don't worry about this. You just come back. And I write in the book about how this man then did something I've never forgotten. He closed his eyes. He threw his head back, and he started to sing. And he sang this old hymn, I'm pressing on the upward way, new heights I'm gaining every day, still praying as I'm onward bound. And then he said, Lord, plant my feet on higher ground. And that man's song changed me. I really knew that I wanted to help condemned people get to higher ground, but mostly I knew that my journey to higher ground was tied to his journey. And it's experiences like that that have absolutely shaped my relationship to the work that I do, to my mission, my purpose, my career. And I think that's what narrative can do. That's what experience can do. It can make you step away from indifference and activate you in ways that I think can be absolutely transformative.
Because you write that you weren't even a lawyer yet. You were just a law student. You go in to meet this man thinking, what in the world am I going to say to him? I don't know what to do. I don't know what to say. And he reassured you.
That's right. That's right. And I think that's the real challenge, Nancy. I think that we've got to get proximate to the places and the people who are oftentimes marginalized, who are abused, who are neglected. We think that we can solve problems from a distance and our solutions don't work because to really be effective, you've got to get proximate. We've been taught, many of us, that if there are bad schools in our community, if there are places where there's violence and despair or drug addiction and dependency, if there are areas where there's abuse and neglect, to stay as far away from those places as possible. I think if we want to change the world, if we want to create more justice, we've actually got to get proximate to the problems. I got proximate to condemned people, And what I learned was that I could actually make a much bigger difference than I thought I could. There's power in proximity. And that man taught me that, and my clients have been teaching me that over the last 30 years.
Well, I was struck by John Stewart's words. He said, discussion of this topic has been white people yelling at each other.
Yeah, I don't think we've done a very good job of even creating a forum for honest discussion. I think we've really been corrupted by what I call the politics of fear and anger. Our politicians have been competing with each other over who can be the toughest on crime, and that has facilitated a discourse that's not even about correction or recovery or rehabilitation or good policymaking or good governance. It's just about showing how tough we are. And whenever a society allows itself to be led by fear and anger, it will tolerate abuse. It will tolerate injustice. And we've seen that in the criminal justice system for the last 40 years. I'd like to think that we're turning a corner now, but it's not inevitable. We've got to have people change that narrative of fear and anger and embrace something more redemptive, more hopeful, more integrated into our values and norms and morals as a larger society.
And you make the point that when a mistake is made, we don't like the errors pointed out. We can resist confronting them. And it took 6 years to get a court to overturn Mr. McMillan's conviction.
One of my great frustrations is that our legal system is much more committed to finality than it is to fairness. And you see that in these cases where there's oftentimes obvious evidence of a wrongful conviction, and courts and judges are too frequently looking for reasons to avoid having to correct these mistakes. I don't know why we don't have conviction integrity units in every state, in every prosecutor's office. I don't know why a prosecutor thinks that his or her role is to just maintain the status quo. If there's a problem, we all benefit by correcting that problem, but we don't have that consciousness yet in our criminal justice system, and that's one of the great challenges. Our system is really unreliable right now. I am persuaded that we have more innocent people in jails and prisons today than we have ever had in our history. You cannot go from 300,000 people in jails and prisons in 1972 and 2.3 million people in jails and prisons today and not have a corresponding increase in the number of innocent people wrongly convicted, particularly where I think we still have a system that treats you better if you're rich and guilty than if you're poor and innocent. Wealth, not culpability, is shaping outcomes in too many jurisdictions.
My guest is Brian Stevenson, and he wrote a memoir, Just Mercy, A Story of Justice and Redemption. And in some cases, you have to go to the court of last resort, 60 minutes. You have to go to TV and tell the story on television. You refer to that as the court of last resort.
Well, I do think that there is this barrier between what happens in jails and prisons, what happens in courts, that shields people from understanding what's going on. And transparency and exposure and revelation are key components to how we're going to get reform. In the McMillan case, which I detail, we went to 60 Minutes not because I think it was going to be key to winning the case, but we couldn't create a narrative about Mr. McMillan's wrongful conviction through the local press. We have, I think, in too many places, this kind of entanglement between the media and local law enforcement and local power structures where everybody protects the dominant narrative, which is that we don't make mistakes. We always get the right person. There is no unfairness, inequality, or injustice in our system. And when media becomes complicit in reinforcing that narrative, even when it's not true, you got to shake things up. And there are a handful of entities and institutions and national perspectives that have made shaking things up a little easier. It's in some ways easier today because the internet has, I think, given us all a little bit more access to create counter narratives in places where they're desperately needed.
Well, you mentioned, you tell the story, for example, of Walter McMillan and other stories of adults, but you also, there are stories about children, and it's heartbreaking.
Yeah. One of the real tragedies of the last quarter century, 40 years or more, is what we've done to kids. I mean, we created a narrative in America that there are some children that are not children. They may look like kids, they may act like kids, but we've said these are not children. We came up with a new term in the 80s. We said that these are, quote, super predators. We use that rhetoric, that language, to justify horrific policies. There are now 14 states with no minimum age for trying a child as an adult. We've got thousands of young kids in adult jails and prisons where they're at risk of being sexually assaulted and victimized. We've put tens of thousands of kids into adult prisons for decades. And I think we just gave up on a generation of children, mostly black and brown kids, and the consequence of that is really shameful. And I document the pain and the anguish I've seen when 14-year-old boys are put in jails where they're sexually assaulted and abused, or where kids are put in circumstances where they are denied the opportunity to develop as healthy human beings. And some of what's happened in that arena is nothing less than cruel and barbaric.
Well, I appreciate the fact that you give these people a name for us. You tell their stories, because I was born and raised in Georgia, and my dad was like other people of his generation in that culture. As long as the other, we called them colored people, those other people. But when it came to someone he knew,
right,
a friend, he was so compassionate and he recognized the injustice. But yeah, he had to know that person and know them by name. And I think that's what you've done for us.
Well, I think it really is the great power of literature and storytelling. I've seen that dynamic that you described with your father with lots and lots of people. I think we're all much more motivated to stand up for people when they're being unfairly treated, to intervene, to say things that need to be said when we recognize that someone we know, someone we care about, our brothers, our sisters, our neighbors, are being mistreated. It becomes personal to us because they are personal to us. And the one thing I wanted to do was to make the clients, the children I've represented, the adults I've represented, the women I've represented who've gone to prison at such astonishingly high rates. We've had a 640% increase in the number of women being sent to prison in the last 20 years. I wanted all of those people to be known and knowable to readers, because I am persuaded that, like your dad, the more we become aware, the more intimate we become with the community of people who are being victimized, the less acceptable their victimization is. And we need some of that outrage, some of that indignation to create the moral courage, I think, that's going to be required to dismantle mass incarceration and excessive punishment.
My guest is Brian Stevenson. He is a lawyer, an attorney, and he has written a memoir, Just Mercy, A Story of Justice and Redemption. One of the touching stories you tell in your book is a condemned man's last day, and all day long, what do you want for breakfast? And what was his reaction?
You know, it really was challenging. It was an early case that I did, and we'd had such success in blocking executions that when we couldn't block this one, it was very difficult. And I went down to be with him before the execution. This was at the time when they still used the electric chair in Alabama. And he was telling me just how strange the day had been. And when I got back there, it was just a few minutes before the execution, he said, "Brian, it's been so strange. All day long, people have been asking me, what can I do to help?" So when I woke up, they asked me, "What do you want for breakfast?" At midday, they said, "What do you want for lunch?" In the evening, they said, "What do you want for dinner?" And he said, they kept coming to me saying, "What can I do to help? Can I get you stamps to mail your last letters? Can I get you water? Can I get you coffee? Can we get you the phone to call your friends?" And this man said to me in those last few minutes, he said, "Brian, it's been so strange." He said, "More people have asked me, what can I do to help you in the last 14 hours of my life than they ever did in the first 19 years of my life." And I was holding his hands thinking, yes, where were they when you were 3 years old and your mom died? Where were they when you were being physically abused? Where were they when you were being assaulted? Where were they when you were drug addicted and homeless? I know where they were when you were accused of this crime. They were lined up to execute you. And that difficulty, that disconnect, was really, really challenging for me to have this man have the hair shaved off his body, then pulled away, strapped into an electric chair and executed, was difficult, but it was almost our inability to recognize that more could have been done, should have been done at a time when it had been meaningful. That was the real hard takeaway for me. And I vowed to him that we would fight harder to get people the help they need to engage in work that could prevent these tragic outcomes. And it's been the direction of the work we've tried to pursue here at the Equal Justice Initiative.
Well, you're a graduate of Harvard Law School. You could have had a comfortable life like your classmates, I'm sure. What keeps you going?
You know, I really believe that justice is a constant struggle, and if you don't struggle to fight for the things that are important, you're going to see retreat, you're going to see injustice. And I think seeing what I've seen, knowing what I know, I really couldn't be comfortable doing anything else. I don't feel for me like there's a choice. If you see something that you can fix, if you see someone you can help, and you know that if you don't fix it and if you don't help, there's going to be suffering and pain, you just do it because you have to. It would be hard to live. It would be hard to be at peace without doing that. And I think that's what's happened to me. And I feel in many ways that's been modeled for me by generations of civil rights activists, people who stood when other people told them to sit down, people who spoke when other people told them to be quiet. They have modeled for me the necessity of giving voice to the things that need to be heard. But more than that, they've modeled for me the power that you feel, the energy that you gather when you stand in the place that you think you are required to stand in the name of justice, in the name of what's right. And I often feel that sense of empowerment, that energy, and that makes it much easier for me to do the things that I do, to keep fighting, to do work, than it would be for me to be silent, to stop, to just be quiet.
Well, I want to personally express my personal appreciation for the work that you do, Mr. Stevenson.
Well, thank you so much for that.
Thank you. Author Brian Stevenson's book is Just Mercy. After a break, I'll be talking to author Terry Richardson about his book, Where I Want to Be. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. After serving in the military, Terry Richardson attended college as a non-traditional student. While attending the University of Northern Iowa in Cedar Falls, he became interested in writing and wrote his first book, This Is How We Do It. After obtaining a master's degree at California State University, Chico, Terry Richardson wrote a second book, Where I Want to Be. He's interested in short stories, fiction, nonfiction, and poetry. Terry Richardson, welcome.
Thank you for having me again.
I'm calling you Terry, but you write under your initials, TJ.
Yes.
Any particular reason you chose to do that?
Well, that's a funny story. When I moved to California, I'm from the South, so I didn't know it was so many Terrys here. We had women named Terry back there. So I went by the name of TJ. That's my first, my name, middle name is James. So I started going by TJ. But when people found out my name was Terry, they looked at me stupid. Like, I know how to say Terry, you know. But I stayed with TJ. My degrees have Terry James Richardson on it. And when I was a boy, when my mother called me Terry and James, I was in a bunch of trouble. So that's her name for me. So I go by both, actually, but also in writing, a lot of writers use their initials. So that's kind of a little trademark, if you will.
So you feel more professional when you use your initials.
I feel professional, and I used them this time in case I continued to write. So
because your first book, you put your name as T.J. Richardson. And your first book, I might remind people, This Is How We Do It. And who was this we when you wrote your first book? Who was the we?
The we was a group of students from San Antonio, Texas, Palo Alto Community College, not Palo Alto, near Sanford here. And we would come. For 19 years, they had a program that came that brought students from San Antonio, Texas to Iowa. Before that, I think the year 1999, if I'm not mistaken, it was like 0.03% of minorities going.
And to this school in Iowa.
To the school in Iowa, yes. And mostly around the nation. So they tried to integrate it more. And so in writing that book, I didn't know that we would be the last group that would graduate from
that
program.
So you were the last one to have this opportunity to go to school in Iowa.
Yes, I was one of the last ones.
Well, what was it like going to a campus where you are such a minority, so few people of your background at this school?
Well, to be honest, which, I mean, I hate that to start because you say to be honest. I mean, I really don't try not to lie. But it was actually more minorities at Cedar Falls than it is here in Chico State. Because we had a football team, so they selected a lot of minorities from all over the nation to come there. But it was special. They kind of trained us. We had like a week. And I guess when they first started off, but, you know, when you come into the 1990s, the year 2000, people are pretty, you know, intermingled better than probably 60s and 70s. And with the internet and everything, people know all the lingo, the slang. So, you know, it was pretty easy. And then I was a non-traditional student, so.
Yeah, I introduced you as a non-traditional student. And what do you mean by that, that you are a non-traditional student?
Well, the definition of non-traditional is like 26 and over.
So, for one thing, you are older students, so you are more mature than the 18-year-olds who go right out of high school into college.
I would say that, yes, a little bit. Most of them, anyway, yes.
My guest is T.J., Terry Richardson, and he has a second book now, Where I Wanna Be. And this new book, you wrote of your experiences somewhat as a non-traditional student and how you went about making decisions.
Yes.
So there you are at this college in Cedar Falls, Iowa. But then how did you get to California?
Wow. This is telling some of the story in the book. When I was at Palo Alto in Texas.
In Texas.
I went to visit a friend in San Francisco, actually. And, you know, I was a little bit, you know, I'd been in my hometown for years, so I was looking for somewhere else to live. And I would have never thought California, although I thought it was beautiful. I had been here before several times, and I had a nice time, and it was beautiful. But I visited that friend, and I stayed here for 6 days during spring break, and I was like, I can do this. And so I just fell in love with California. Well, I got an opportunity to go to Iowa. All my teachers at Palo Alto were telling me, you need a bachelor's degree. You can't, you know, you need to further your education. That's what it was. And, you know, being a non-traditional student, my circle was the teachers who had master's and bachelor's. So that was my group. And so it was time for me to get one, actually. So I went to Iowa. And when I was in Iowa for like 2 weeks, and I found out about a national student exchange from other students. And so one guy had been to Bowie State in Washington, and one had been to Florida International. And so, I mean, these were young guys, and they were like, man, you need to do this. So that was my opportunity to come to Chico State. And I was trying to get in the Bay, but Chico was pretty much the only school, Northern California, accepting National Student Exchange students. So
you came here as an exchange student.
Yes. I'm so strange.
Because we normally think of foreign exchange students.
Yeah.
But you were coming here from Iowa. And did you experience any culture shock coming from first Texas and then Iowa and then here to Chico?
The culture shock I experienced in Iowa, of course, it's different cultures in both places, actually. It was cold. Very cold. Snow cold. 4 inches snow, below zero cold. And I endured it. I liked it. I wanted to try something different. And so Iowa was cool. It was okay.
It was literally cool.
It was literally, yeah, cool, yeah. Blizzard cold. My friends would say the polar bears were running the people out of Walmart to get a heating blanket. That's how cold it was. But, yes, it was really cold, and I knew it before I went. And so a lot of people didn't think I would make it there, but I had fought the cold when I was in Germany in the military. So I really had a wonderful time there. It was good being in the snow. The first snow we had, I went and got me a snow shovel, and I got me the scraper for my windshield. Man, I thought my neighbor was cool. I said, I got to get one of these. But it stayed cold for 5 months. It was like on the ground, and it just got old, you know. And so, you know, so that was Iowa. But California it's still a culture shock, actually. It's so different. It's so different than anywhere I've been. A good different. That's why I'm still here. It's a little bit more, even from Texas, it's a little bit more to do, which seems to make it a East Coast style a little faster. But even in Chico, I could live here and go to Portland. I could go to different places. So it's so much to see here. So
my guest is T.J. Richardson, Terry Richardson. And he wrote his first book, This Is How We Do It. And then after getting a master's degree at California State University, Chico, he has written a second book, Where I Want to Be. And Terry, I really liked the whole tone of your new book. Tell people how you set it up.
I set it up. Okay, that's an interesting story. I got a chance to go back to Texas in May once I got my degree. And so I visited my family. I hadn't seen them in about 2 years there in Texas. One of my professors, actually my writing professor here, creative writing professor, he kind of put it out there that he would edit it for me because, I mean, you don't write nothing without getting it edited. I mean,
no, even the best writers, people who go to the university on a writing scholarship, they have editors. So you're right. I mean, a writer needs an editor.
Yeah, it's like, you know, somebody put it out. I'm in a writing club, and she put it like it's like, you know, cleaning your own house, and you got stuff sitting around. Well, a professional that cleans it up could make it look a lot better. And so that being said, I met Gina, which is my editor. I met her online. I'm pretty sure you read that. And she was from Norman, Oklahoma, actually. She had went to, which I've been there several times, Oklahoma University. But she lived in a town called San Antonio, Texas, which is where I'm from. And, you know, that being said, I went online to look for an editor, which I hardly ever do. But I found this company. And they were really instrumental because, I mean, they protected you and protect, you know, they were showing you ways that they protect you and protect your money if you're going to hire an editor. And so Gina, she really directed me and like she just went through the whole paper and she was like, Terry, she was very nice. She was like, Terry, just because you're interested in Ghirardelli's in San Francisco, in Alcatraz, in the Golden Gate Bridge and stuff. She was like telling me, giving me pointers about my reader. What would my reader like? I got to write it, you know, talking
with
about
your reader in mind.
With my reader in mind, which I knew a little bit, but as you can tell me talking, I tell a lot of stories, and I was in the military too, so.
Well, and I wondered too, who is your intended audience? when you say where I want to be, and when you were writing these stories in your book, who were you imagining as reading your book?
Well, Gina, she wrote, she told me about being more motivational, which that's a lot of books that I read. So actually, where I want to be is a rhetorical question. I talk about my defining moment and, you know, where it led me to believe that it was more for me in life, and I still think it's more. So my audience are motivated people. If you will allow me, the ones who gave me reviews, all of them are like 21. And so, and the people that I interviewed, most of them are like 21 working on their PhDs or whatever, but they kind of motivated me, and they're like upbeat, and everybody wants to have goals. That's the first of the year, and everybody like, you know, weight goals and stuff like that. But, you know, when you go to college, everything is about goals. When you, you know, all you can do is imagine how it's going to be after you get your PhD or your master's or whatever. And so I wrote it to that audience, college students, actually, again. My graphic designer was a college student that I met. He's in L.A. now. He's not even a graphic designer. He wants to be a fireman. So it just moved me to, like, you know, people get older and they don't want to pass the baton. And so, I mean, I'm open, so I'm passing the baton. The guy who told others about my book on social media, he works for FedEx, but I gave them an opportunity, and it was just great that they wanted to see me succeed because they got a chance to work on their craft at the same time. So these are the type of people that that's my audience, and to stamp it and to put is my audience is people who have a desire to do something with their life, first of all, but also to write. And so, and they just thank me that and encourage me to keep writing, actually. So
my guest is T.J. Richardson, Terry Richardson, and his second book is Where I Want to Be. And you mentioned having interviewed people. How many interviews, how many people did you include in your book?
It wasn't as many as the first one, 4 or 5. And so.
So you interviewed these people because how did you go about selecting these particular people?
That's a crazy question. the first book, I interviewed them because they were going through the program. And so that went so well over that I thought, let's interview some more people. And my first guy that I interviewed, he kind of inspired me to write the book. When I came back from Texas, I was a little heartbroken. I didn't feel like writing anymore. This is a long story. I didn't feel like writing anymore. But David says, hey, you're going to take my story. And so, I don't know. I believe in fate. I believe, and that's a mild way to put it. But I believe in God, to be honest. But it was like this guy, I had known him for a year and a half, and he kept telling me he had a story. I did not know he was the oldest of 8, and he was like the guardian of the family because both of his parents did drugs in Sacramento. And so we sat in that this burger joint here. What's the name of that big burger joint that the kids go to here? Wow. Burgers and Brew. And it's like I'm talking to a stranger because I didn't know his story, you know. He knew some of my story from the first book. And then the second guy I interviewed, after he bought my first book, I told him I might want to write a second one. He says, well, I want to be in that book. And I hope I'm not getting ahead of myself, but he was my tutor. And so I was writing the first time I met him, I was writing a page of this big mansion across the street, Bidwell Mansion. And so he said, well, the next book you write, I want to be in it. Knew him a year and a half. We over at one of the libraries at Chico State. He said he wants to be president. It's like, well, yeah. It's like, because I don't want to be president. I never had that. That's never been an admiration. I don't like people's, you know, contradicting, you know, telling me that I did something. It's like, hey, I don't like that. But he wants to be president, and he's really into politics.
Well, do you know, when I was teaching at a different college before I, just before I came to Chico, there was a young man from Ghana. Mm-hmm. He's absolutely so personable, and his ambition was to go back home and become president of Ghana. And I lost track of him, but I thought, boy, if anybody could do that, it would be him.
Yeah.
He just had that about him. And here you have this guy, I mean, the United States is a big country, who says, I'm going to be president one day.
Yeah, and he's really courageous about it, 5'2", Latino. And he says, you don't see many of those. And now, whoever the guy was from Cuba, Castro. I say, Castro? You know. But, you know, anybody could be president. I still think so. I don't know if I'll see it again in my day. I don't really think one group is smart, especially when it comes to women. I think y'all are a lot smarter than we are, really.
Now, so, women are going to love you, Terry.
Well, that's...
After a break, I'll be continuing my conversation with author Terry Richardson, whose second book is Where I Want to Be. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman. I'm Nancy Wiegman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio, and I'm back with my guest, author Terry Richardson. There are so many things in your book that I thought, gosh, I want to write that down.
Mm-hmm.
Because at one point you say, the problem arises when the destination is never defined. So that's what you're encouraging these, you mentioned you're aiming at college students, say, and that's what you're encouraging them to do. Where do you want to be? Like this kid that says, I want to be president. But you say the problem arises when the destination is never defined. So you came up with where you want to be, and you're encouraging other people, your readers, to know where is it that you want to be. And that comes up to being another sentence that I wrote down in your book. And this isn't original with you. Greek philosophers told us this too, but we should know who we are. That seems so simple, Terry. But I don't think it is. I think a lot of times people go through almost their whole life believing what their parents told them they were. I mean, I know a doctor who I'm sure his parents said, okay, we want you to be a doctor. And that really wasn't what he wanted in life, but they told him that's who he is. And so I think a lot of times we don't really know who we are. We only go by what other people have told us we are or who. Other people have told us we are. So I think that's what your book, too, is inspiring people. Figure out who we are. I remember Ellen DeGeneres said, figure out who you are and be that person.
That's a good quote. Yeah, it's just, they decorate that quote. Yes. Yeah, I think in a lot of ways you're still trying to figure out who you are. Somebody said, it might have been Oprah, it matters what they call you, it's what you answer to. That's why in biblical times and in old Greek times, your name meant a lot. That's why I move around my name. So your name meant a lot. And so, you know, like you say, you got to know who you are and what you want to be and what you, because there's so many people, like I said, I've been called a lot of things, really, not by choice and not, you know, I think not intentional. People been angry at me or just, you know, thought, something about me that wasn't true, thought my intentions were different than what they are, like where I want to be. It's a bridge there. And actually, it's the name of a second song. And you didn't know that. That's not in the book. But Maybe you'll get to that, but the reason I wrote it, because I kept hearing this song, Where I Want to Be. And it kind of was at a time in my defining moment.
You mentioned that, and you ask your interviewees, what was your defining moment? And I don't think people always recognize it when it comes.
Yeah. Winston Churchill. That was his big thing, his defining moment. And if you look at the end, I put my shiny moment when I graduated. But
there's a photograph of you, and you are so happy. You have this happy expression on your face in your cap and gown.
That picture is in Chico State at the Behavioral Sciences. It's right there because people, and it was in the Instagram, they love that picture. I was at the graduation, and they tucked that up. I mean, I vaguely remember it, but.
Well, I could see why they would want to take your picture because you have this humongous smile on your face.
I just got my master's. I was like, that was a hurdle there, but yes.
And you quote David Barrett, the words in music, about one shining moment.
Yes. Oh, so many people have sung that song. Luther Vandross was one. He did a really good. He's a singer, you know. But it talks about a basketball game, actually, and it's, you know, giving it all you got.
Well, now, this brings up, and I think he was an athlete. Tyler Perry, you mentioned him in your book. And, I'd heard of him, but I did not know that in 2011, Forbes magazine listed Tyler Perry as the highest paid man in entertainment. Wow. And his story is one of coming up from...
Yeah, he
It didn't
he
have it
homeless.
Handed to him.
Yeah, yes.
He didn't inherit a big company from his dad.
His dad told him he couldn't make it. He didn't get along with his dad. So, yes. He's been one of a person that I followed. And, you know, I'm from the South. He was in New Orleans. He's got a big studio in Atlanta. They named a street after him in Atlanta. Just a huge guy and a huge influence on a lot of people. And, yes.
In fact, one of the points you make in your book is to surround yourself with people who inspire you. And people like Tyler Perry are an inspiration to the rest of us.
Yeah.
What he has done, what he's accomplished. And he's also a philanthropist.
Yes. Oh, yes.
And here's what I can do with what I have earned. And Tyler Perry takes advantage of that to do good.
You know, I'm flattered by anybody that would give anything. They don't have to.
Exactly.
You know what I'm saying? Yeah. I've heard of Bill Gates giving away half of his money. I mean, but you don't have to. So you need to be thankful for that. Everybody don't do that make money, you know. So, yes.
But you encourage us to take inspiration from these people, to surround yourself with people who inspire you, and let the ones who want to put you down, let them go.
Yeah.
And
That's motivation. That was part of my defining moment, you know. I had to make up my mind. I was getting older, you know. And people tell me today, you've changed. And I say, I had to. I tell them, I had to. I was getting run over by life. Life was pushing me around. I had to change.
Well, you know what, Terry? A lot of people say, well, that's just the way I am, and I'm not going to change. And yeah, I saw your expression. That's the way I feel, too. And you have never, I'm sure you've never said that that's the way I am and I'm not going to change, because you just said you did change.
Well, we all evolve. People that I went to school with, social media, they expect you to be the same person you was then. And that's kind of nonsense, because we all evolve. And sometimes you evolve because you want to. And that's part of, you know, going where you want to be, because, you know, the world is pulling you, you know, just TV, actually, just social media, you know, you can be pulled in every direction. But I had to change. I was getting older, and I'm ambitious. A lot of people, I believe people are ambitious, as they wouldn't be jealous of other people, but they don't know how to go about getting it, getting what you're trying to get too, you know. And so I had to change. I was getting older. I didn't do everything I wanted to do in life. I wasn't even at the beginning, you know. And I can say different now. The second half of my life is better and getting better than the first half was.
My guest is T.J. Richardson, Terry Richardson, and his book is Where I Want to Be. And he encourages, and your book mainly aimed at, say, college-age students, and you want them to figure out who they are and where they want to be. And your book has stories in it. You interviewed people and took their stories, and these are inspiring stories, people who overcame, you know, having to take care of their siblings at a young age or various challenges that these individuals had, and you chose to tell their stories. Who are some of the other stories that you selected?
Well, I did get a professor of mine. He helped me do my thesis on my comprehensive essay, which that's the next thing I'm thinking about getting published, actually. But this is a super guy. I mean, you got to like him. But I didn't know his story. I'd known him a whole year. We sat down like you and I am, and you see how I talk. I didn't get a word in. He just started off with his speech. Texas El Paso is where he was at. I'm from Texas. I was in the guy's class. I didn't know he did all of his time in El Paso, pretty much. As an administrator at 26 years old, he worked with some of the politicians there.
And he could have taken another route in his life.
Yeah, he could.
More or less kind of handed to him.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yes. That one. Well, he was part of his uncle was part of the, what's that day we celebrate? I mean, they got fruit. They plant fruit and stuff. Jesus harvest. His uncle was somewhat like that. And he told him he could have been a millionaire by the time he was 30.
And this professor of yours chose to go into teaching instead of this lucrative. He could have been a wealthy man if he'd followed his uncle's advice.
Yes.
And he was strong enough to say, no, that's
at
not
a young
me.
Age, too. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and another thing he did that I didn't know, I'm into sports a little bit. So the first, I want to say all minority, which was all black team, college, was out of Texas El Paso, Western College. Well, they invited him to give his speech when these guys were giving his speech. The great Pat Riley for the Lakers, he played on the team in Kentucky that played this team. And I was like, I was moved. We didn't talk about that much, but this guy, he was just an inspiration. These are stories, you know.
Well, since we're paying him such compliments, let's give his name, Dr. Charles Zartman.
Yes.
Is this wonderful guy who said, no thank you to becoming a wealthy farmer, I'm going to choose teaching. And he was recognized, his superiors recognized that here's a guy with talent for doing what he's doing. He's inspiring to these young kids. And so Dr. Charles Zartman was also an inspiration to you.
Oh, very much so. Very much so. Oh, the way I met him, I was thinking about getting my master's. When I tell people I got my master's, they more fired up about it than I am sometimes, really. And but I just, like I said, I didn't want to go back to Texas. I'm from Texas. I just spent all my life there, and I pretty much did there what I did here. I saw it all. I did it all, you know, that I wanted to do, that inspired me. And so I saw him walking one day at the college, and he says, even before I met my advisor, Celeste Jones, was a really good friend and really inspirational in getting me in her program. And I told him what I wanted to do. I wanted to be, my degree is in social science. I wanted to be an advisor, student advisor. Say the best schools to go to are San Marcos in Texas. And it was another school. And he knew exactly what he was talking about.
Dr. Zartman.
He's been around. And so the next time I saw him, he was on a cane. He had hurt his hip playing handball or something. And so when I got into that program, I found out that he helped with comprehensive essays, and I had to have him. But I told the class this story, and he was flattered. He was like, thank you. And then he told me, I think he told me that he wouldn't mind speaking in my book. Because I gave him the first book. I was like, here. He's like, oh. And so the next time I saw him with Gustavo Matilda,
one of your other featured interviewees.
He says, I read his book.
So Dr. Zartman had read the book of the young guy who wants to be president.
No, he had read my book.
Oh,
so, but
yeah.
He made me look good in the young guy. He was one of the first ones to buy it. He said, I have too. So it, both of them ended up, that was before I interviewed either one of them. And so, no, but Dr. Zartman, he's just, I don't know, just somebody special. He helped me with that comprehensive essay too. Just, I had to write it over like 6 times. So, you know.
Well, I mentioned that you have something about Tyler Perry in your book because he is an inspiration. And then there's an author, Carl Lentz, who wrote In the Moment, and you quote him. He's a pastor in New York City. And here's what you quote from him. How did you get there? How did you get there? You just kept working, loving, reaching out, doing what you do rather than lamenting what you can't do while watching others do what they do. So he, like you said earlier, don't be looking at somebody else and envying them. He said, you just keep working, loving, reaching out, doing what you do rather than lamenting what you can't do.
Yeah.
And I have a feeling you're like that.
Yes.
That describes
well,
you.
Well, if you read the first paragraph, the prefix my teacher wrote about me, yes, my professor, another professor actually, but... Carl Lentz, he's still an inspiration. He came from the big church in Australia, Hillsong. He wanted to teach there, and so he moved to New York City. I think he's from America, but he moved to New York City, and he became a pastor. And Tyler Perry quotes him. It's called Own the Moment, and I quote him several times. He tells this story real quick. About being in New York. He's played basketball with Kevin Durant. He's played with some of the big ball players. Matter of fact, he played in college. He's only a little taller than me, but he made it all the way to college, you know. And he tells a story about giving away his tennis shoes. I don't want to sound gross, but he only wear them one time. He was a freak like some of the younger people that, you know, he'd buy a $100 pair of tennis shoes and give them away. Well, he gave a pair to one of his, a guy that he played ball with. He didn't know him at the time that much. And it just shows you how much the world doesn't show love all the time. This guy was very thankful. He would say, you don't have to give me those shoes. As a matter of fact, he says, what are you doing? He says, obviously, I'm giving you my shoes. He said, you don't have to do that for me. He said, you don't have to do that for me. He says, yeah, I'm giving you these shoes, man. And so the guy says, you know, that's the nicest thing anybody ever done for me. You know what Carl Lentz told him? He said, you need some new friends.
Well, thank you for writing this book, Terry, Where I Want to Be, to encourage people to figure out who they are and where they want to be.
You're welcome.
My guest has been T.J. Richardson, Terry Richardson, and his newest book is Where I Want to Be.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.